We want to get started on time. We have wonderful information to share with you today, and I must say it's just fantastic to see so many people in this room on a topic like corrections. I'm Jeannie Woodford. I'm your new General Services Board member, Class A member. This is the first meeting. This is the first meeting that I'm going to lead, so I'm a little nervous but excited, and you'll never get the smile off my face today. It's just awesome to be here. But they gave me some chores, so let me do those first. I want to remind everyone that the special needs seating section is exclusively for those who need that area because of their disabilities. And then I would like to ask now for a moment of silence in gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 70 years. Today, if you look on the schedule, we were to have three speakers, Karen Freeman Wilson, David Tristan, and Jill Brown. Karen Freeman Wilson, unfortunately, will not be here due to circumstances beyond her control. Jill Brown will attend the conference, but she won't be here today because of some problems with air transportation. She'll be arriving this evening. She'll be at Rogers Center this evening and tomorrow morning to receive a copy of the big book, so you can meet Jill Brown there. We have had two volunteers to help us today, two people who are very experienced in the area of corrections, and that is Mike C. and Diane, who will replace the two speakers who can't make it today, and I know that they'll share wonderful information, and we'll be thrilled to have them here. Our first speaker today is David Tristan. Mr. Tristan used to be my boss. Well, he is now retired from the California Department of Corrections, but he brought to the California Department of Corrections his absolute fantastic leadership. And it's just a pleasure to be able to introduce him today. And so here's David Tristan.
Thank you, Jeannie. Diane was looking at my notes, and she saw that they were in Spanish. And she said, okay, I think she was thinking, is he in the wrong group or what? But I made some notes for my talk yesterday on the same subject, which was in Spanish for the Hispanic that are from all over the world here with dealing with the same issue of corrections. And so I've translated often from English to Spanish, but I've never translated from Spanish back into English. So so bear with me. The first thing I'd like to do is to thank all of you for your efforts, for your work, for the tremendous support that you give the prison systems wherever you're from, regardless of whether you're from Canada, the United States, or other parts of the world. It has just been absolutely phenomenal to meet just people in the lobby of the elevator and the street, the hot dog stands that are here, and you guys are from all over the world, and it's just phenomenal to me. The exchange that goes on makes me feel like, you know, I want to get back involved, more involved, just because of the synergy that occurs with all the people sharing and encouraging one another. So the first thing I'd like to do is thank you and encourage you. Don't get discouraged, and don't let people in the system, the prison system, discourage you, okay? When I was invited here, I was invited by Doug Richardson, and he says, I understand that you have about 32 years experience in the system and prison system, and I said, yes, I do, and he said, would you come speak? And I said, it would be an honor and a pleasure, and it has been. But what he didn't know when he asked me was that I had had similar problems to what you folks have faced. I grew up at a time in which, at least in my neighborhood, where I grew up, Abadio, where you weren't a man and you weren't macho unless you drank. And the more that you drank, the more macho that you were. Now, obviously, we looked pretty stupid stumbling around as 12 and 13-year-olds, but we thought we were really manly. Whether it was fortunate or not, I believe that God has a plan for our lives. My plan in my life was to be a musician. I started playing when I was 13 years old in the bars, and back at that time, nobody cared. I was like a novelty walking in the back door, but I got offered drinks, and then when I said that I couldn't get up in the morning to go to school, somebody said, well, here's a little white pill, take this, it'll make you feel good. Then I said, well, I can't go to sleep at night after I take the little white pill. We'll take a little red pill and it'll be fine. I says, well, now I can't play because I feel terrible. We'll have a few drinks, kid, before you. So by the time I was 13 or 14 years old, I was already using drugs and drinking pretty heavy. I say that it's only by the grace of God that I wasn't in prison like many of my friends and relatives. Most of my friends and relatives are either in prison or dead as a result of gangs, drug, and alcohol. So I believe that I've experienced both sides of the aisle, even though I never wanted to work in a prison. Never. I don't know about Jeannie. She might have had that dream in her life, but I didn't. The only reason I started working in an institution was because I was hungry and they offered me a job. And I said, what the heck is a nice guy like me doing in a place like this? And when I walked into what they call a day room, I realized that most of the people in there were just like me. And I realized that they were no different than me. And I said, well, these are the guys from the hood. I know these people. I mean, they have different names. And I tell people that God has a sense of humor. Now, AA refers to a higher power. I refer to that higher power as my Lord and Savior. And I believe that it's only by God's grace and His plan and His sense of humor that someone who wanted to be a musician, wanted to live free, wanted to use drugs and drink myself to death, wound up in a cell block, you know, trying to be the officer instead of the inmate. I think I found it sometimes easier to be the inmate than it was the officer. But it's just amazing because when I applied for corrections, when I applied, you had to fill out an application and you had to list whether you had used drugs or not. And it said that if you lied and they were going to check references, you wouldn't get hired. So I told the truth. And they said, you will not get hired by the department. Because I got a letter back saying you've been disqualified. I said, well, I'm going to appeal it. And so I appealed it. And I said, listen, I don't have a criminal record. I quit. I've done this. I'm this, 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 and this. And the people that came up and testified, they said, well, you know, we don't think because of his character and this and that and the other. And I said, if I didn't have the kind of character, and at the time I didn't know God was working in my life, then I wouldn't have been able to stop. And so the state personnel board said, yes, we'll let him in. 20 years later, I'm supervising the people that testified against me. And the reason I'm telling you this little story is not because I feel that I'm good or I'm great or anything like that. It's because I believe that God has a purpose in your life. And God loves you. There is a God, and He does love you, and He does have a plan for you. And the Bible says that the plans that He has for you are good and not evil, that you may have a hope and a future. And I'm just absolutely thrilled that you folks are willing to dedicate your lives to this kind of work. I want to share a little bit of statistics with you, and if Jeannie, who is now the boss, she has the most recent information, so if I say something that I may be in error on, then she'll correct me, please. But one of the things that I begin to notice, at least in the California prison system, and I begin to ask different people that were experts in the issues of drug and alcohol abuse, and I've also been talking to inmates and looking at data, begin to realize that the prison system was absolutely exploding. At one time, California was pretty steady, but somewhere between 17 to 20,000 inmates on a regular basis. We had 12 institutions, and we had our problems, issues, and ups and downs. But then the population just exploded, and it went to 40,000. And I thought to myself, we're going to crash and burn. But by the grace of God, we didn't. And then it went up to 60,000. By the time I retired, we were the largest prison system in the world outside of China, with 160,000 in California. At the current time, I checked the internet just before I got here, and it was about 163,000. But the population moves up and down pretty fast. There are approximately one of the reasons I was interested in speaking to the Spanish-speaking members, because the fastest growing population in California is Hispanic in the prisons. It used to be at one time that they were about 30% of the population. They're now 37%. That's the difference between 48,000 and 60,000 Hispanics in the prison system. Somewhere between 20 to 24,000 of those are illegal immigrants who do not want to go. Most of them do not want to go back to their country of origin. Their life has been better here. Their families have been here, are better here. Their children are here, whatever. And besides that, California can't enter into a treaty with another nation. We can do prisoner exchange, things like that. But most of the time, most of the people that I talked to did not want to go back. So the reason I'm saying this is because if you are going into the prisons, and it doesn't, my understanding now is that the Hispanic population has exploded throughout the United States. I've spoken to people here in Canada who says there are Hispanics in Canada now from Mexico. There's in Florida, whether it's Cuban or Hispanic, New York, Washington, Oregon. just, I mean, my wife and I have seen people on the highway, and we talk to them, and they're on their way to some of the most northern states. They're Hispanics from Mexico looking for work. A lot of these folks are going to get themselves in trouble, and they're going to wind up in prison. So if you can encourage your Spanish-speaking friends in AA to accompany you into the prison system, maybe it will prevent some of these people from winding up in the correctional system, and hopefully will be, you know, productive contributors. I don't know where you stand on the issue of immigration. That's not what I'm trying to address. What I'm trying to address is the issue that all of us have problems. It doesn't matter whether we're white, Hispanic, black, Asian, or, you know, from other nations. We all have the same kinds of weaknesses and the same kind of issues, the same kind of fears, the same kind of hopes and dreams. But with your help and the help of your Spanish-speaking friends, maybe we can begin to impact the recidivism rate, which is just absolutely phenomenal in the prison system. Now, in my experience, we get somewhere between 10,000 to 12,000 new inmates into the prison system a month, and we parole out about the same amount, close to the same amount. So, and a lot of these are people who are recidivating. Most of the people, when I worked in parole, most of the people that went back to prison did not go back with a one-time automatic big crime. Most of them began to slip little by little. They wouldn't show up to the parole office because they were going to test dirty or they were hungover. They didn't go to the AA meeting that I was requiring them to go to because they knew that somebody there would be able to identify that they had been drinking and would want to take them under their wing. They begin to... Some of them don't like you guys. But but... Well, I know at the parole agent, I said, why? I had people tell me, why are you making me go to AA? You're mandating this. My conditions of parole do not require this. I'm not an alcoholic. I just like to drink, you know. And I would say, well, that's the same thing that I say. You know, I'm not an alcoholic. I like to drink. You know, I like it a lot. But one thing that I did notice was that as people were leaving the prison system, regardless of whether they were men or women, and going into the community, if they had a support system, many of whom didn't, and they were able to connect into with a local AA group, then their chances of success were going to be much greater than if they just went out there. Because a lot of the people that are in prison, as some of you may know or may have experienced, don't have a home. I was amazed a few years ago. Jeannie was part of the group, I think, that went out. We went to Los Angeles one evening. I said, because I heard some wardens complaining about the clientele that we had in the prison system. We wouldn't have any problems if we just had a better class of inmates. You know? So, am I right, Jim? And so I said, well, let's have a meeting in Los Angeles, and we're going to walk to dinner from a hotel, a very nice hotel right in the middle of downtown Los Angeles, in Iotani. It's very expensive, very nice. We walked, and I saw the inmates we did act like inmates, didn't we, in that environment. We all huddled together and kind of walked over to Olvera Street, and people were saying, oh, my gosh, this is really bad. Then we took a drive in a van that parole agents that worked the streets took us, and we saw people shooting up in street corners, four, five, six of them, all standing there sharing their needles. We saw others drunk, falling down. We saw children walking in and around all of these people. I saw police officers driving down the street just looking, and didn't stop anybody from doing it. People arranging their cardboard boxes to where they were going to sleep that night with children. And this went on for blocks. Now, we didn't see that during the day, but that happened at night, because during the day they were walking around on the streets. And the point that I was trying to make was, this is our clientele. This is their world. This is what drugs and alcohol has done to them. This is the lie that I believe, at least in my heart, that Satan perpetuates. If you drink, you'll be more macho. You'll be better looking. You'll have better friends. You'll be able to play better sports. You know, you'll be able to do everything. And in reality, it's a lie from the pit of hell. It is a lie that I believe I used to tell inmates. Satan says, if I can't have your soul, I will ruin your life. So my message at that point was, this is our clientele. This is their reality. This is what the parole agents have to work with. This is what they struggle with. And this is a struggle that these people are facing on a daily basis. And had it not been for the grace of God, we would be there. Some of us would be there ourselves. Now, in my experience, and I'm not sure that we have any hard data, but
About 85% of the people that are in prison are as a result of drugs and alcohol, or drugs, the combination of drugs and alcohol, when they committed their crime. The most of the violent crimes, when I was reading the C-files, oh, thank you. She could tell I'm starting to go like this. This is what I used to do in the warden's meetings. When I used to chair them. They're very difficult to chair, aren't they, Jeannie? But approximately 100%, at least in my experience, of the violent crimes were committed under the influence of alcohol. Almost 100% of the domestic violence was under the influence of alcohol and sometimes speed or meth. And what is really, really tragic at the current time is the percent of hepatitis C amongst the prison population. And what was surprising to me was that the hepatitis C percentage was higher for the women in prison than for the men. Now, you know, as well as I do, that alcohol destroys your liver. So when you have a combination of hepatitis C and you're an alcoholic, it's just a recipe for disaster. So, you know, I don't know of anybody that has this problem that shouldn't be encouraging other people and bringing other people into AA. Now, I was talking to a young lady outside, a couple of young ladies, and we were talking about how and why inmates go to AA meetings. And I began to realize when I started working in the prison system that a lot of them went to AA simply to get out of their cells. But it doesn't matter. Because I said the first time that I went to church was because I was down and out and there was a spaghetti dinner for a dollar. So I went to go get spaghetti for a dollar. So, and then I listened to somebody say something about God, and I went, oh, yeah, that's nice. And then, I went back again, and, had some more. And then I said, wow, maybe there is something to this. The one thing that I want to leave you with is that AA, in some areas, is hurting. And the reason I say that it's hurting is because a lot, I don't know about the other states, but in California, some of our prisons are in very remote areas or in very small communities, or they're in communities where there's a very small Spanish-speaking population. And if there is a Spanish-speaking population there, they're there illegally, and they don't want to come into the prison system and volunteer their time. Because they say, I'm going to have to show some documentation. I don't have any. I'm out here working in the fields or, working in the back of a kitchen or something, but I cannot volunteer my time at a prison. But if there's one thing that I hope I leave you with is encouragement to go out and do the very best that you can with what you have to encourage other people. I was told that that one of the people here is a warden on the panel, and he's a member. And I want to share one last thing with you, and that is that in my experience, there's a lot of staff in the prison system that work in the prison that are alcoholics themselves. Some of the reasons that they do not really want to hear or see or whatever Alcoholics Anonymous is because it's kind of looking like looking in the mirror. And I would ask you not to put those people down if they say something that is not entirely encouraging. Invite them to a meeting. Say, join us, because there is sometimes a fear of facing reality. And someone told me a little while ago that the first thing that happens when someone tells you the truth is you get angry, Like the first time someone says, you drink too much. I said, I don't drink too much. I know exactly how much I drink, And it's not too much, not according to my standards. I didn't remember what I did the following day or how I got home, but it wasn't too much because I did get home. I would just encourage you to be encouragers to the staff because sometimes it's very, very difficult to work in that environment day in and day out. Sometimes see the same people coming back over and over and over again. Sometimes I used to see a young man that I knew 30 years ago, then I'd see him back, and then someone would walk up to me and say, did you know so-and-so? And I would say, yes, and I'm their son. And they were back in. And it was like a cycle, a vicious cycle. And you know what that cycle is, of the abuse, the alcoholism in the family, the son, the daughter acquires the alcoholism, the abuse, whether it's physical, mental, emotional, or otherwise, continues, and the solution is the problem. The solution that they think is theirs, is alcohol or drugs, so that they can forget. But it's not. It just contributes to the problem and to the cycle. So I'm thankful that you're here. I'm thankful that you've broken the cycle. I'm thankful that you're trying to break the cycle for others. And I just really, really just thank you for all of the energy, all the synergism, all of the encouragement that you folks have given me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tristan. And I want everyone to know that I do accept his challenge of getting more of you into the prisons in California and I hope in other states around the nation. Just this year, just to let you know, when I became the director, we gave $35,000 out to each of the prisons in California to cover any guarding costs that they needed so that we could bring in more self-help groups, including AA. And as Mr. Tristan talked about, he used to meet with the wardens. Well, we have a wardens meeting every other month, and every single time I meet with them, I ask them how they're doing in bringing their AA groups into their facilities. And I've asked them to meet with their sponsors quarterly, and I hope in the states that you're in that you're developing those same kinds of relationships with the leadership of the Department of Corrections where you are. As Dave mentioned, California is one of the largest departments of corrections, and we're not proud of that. And really, my goal is to close prisons, and as many as we can. I need your help. And so that brings us to our next speaker, Mike C. Please welcome Mike C.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic. First of all, very grateful to Jill Brown, who's the warden of San Quentin, for not showing up. I was sitting there trying to figure out how I feel, and I said to myself, what a couple other people I heard say today, I'm nervous. And I thought, I'm not nervous. I'm excited. What a tremendous privilege to be able to address, you know, to talk at this particular event. I'm just so thrilled. So I want to thank folks on the panel here who are organizing the meeting for inviting me and my sponsor, Tom, who volunteered me up. Tom says, come here, I need to talk to you for a minute. And Diane, at the same moment, came over and she said, are you going to have any trouble with this? And I just still didn't know what this was. And Tom says, he's not going to have any trouble with this. And I'm really not going to have any trouble with this in the sense of, I really hope that I can bring a message that's useful to some people and that I can share with you what God wants me to share. I am an alcoholic. And I swore, like so many others, that I would never be one. I live on the East Coast. I keep forgetting, you know, we're from all over the world. I grew up on the East Coast of Canada. I do work in the field of corrections for the federal government. Our particular part of the correctional service in Canada, we manage all federal corrections for the four eastern provinces, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, and Newfoundland. And I live in Moncton. Everybody knows where Moncton is, I'm sure. And if you don't, you should. It's a great place. But, in any case, I live there, and I work at Westmoreland Institution. And for the moment, I'm the warden of Westmoreland Institution. And like the previous speaker, I never wanted to work in jails. Trust me, I never did. Let me get to it quickly. I have about 20 minutes, but I get carried away, and I. One of the things I asked God to do when I was kind of getting ready for this was to just let me keep it down, keep it to where I want to go. My first drink that counted was about 15 years old. It wasn't my first drink. My first drink was when I was 7 years old. And it's funny, to this day, I mean, the circumstances are weird. I should just take a second to explain them to you. It's kind of important. I grew up in an alcoholic family. My father was a little guy, and he drank a lot, and he was violent when he drank. My grandfather was a big guy. He was a wonderful person, and he wasn't violent when he drank. So I wanted to be like him. So my father, my grandfather, my uncle were in the kitchen one day drinking beer. And I grabbed my grandfather's glass, and I took a mouthful. And the first thing that happened was my mother slapped me across the face. And I, not understanding that she was living with full-blown alcoholism at the time, and what had just happened literally scared her to death, I responded like any normal 7-year-old would. Internally, as you bitch. Yeah. I swear to God, I can remember that like it was yesterday. I can remember the taste, the smell, and everything else about it. I didn't drink after that for a while. Until I went on the wagon until I was 9 years old. We had a lady living with us who came from the Ukraine. Ours was an international event, too. She came from the Ukraine after the Second World War and lived with us, and Maria got married, and so we had a Ukrainian wedding. Ever been to a Ukrainian wedding? They're great. One of the traditions at a Ukrainian wedding is you go up and you throw $2 in the hat. It's probably more than that now. But anyway, at that time, you threw $2 in the hat, you took a shot of rum, you downed it, and you danced with the bride. So I kind of looked to see where my parents were. Nobody was looking. I don't know why I had $2 in my pocket, but I did. I put the $2 in the hat. They passed me the rum. I downed it and danced with Maria. But the second thing that happened was, but then I was looking around to see if anybody saw me so I wouldn't be in trouble again, you know. So from the very start, this was not a joyful event. When I was 15 years old, I never drank again very much, or if at all, until I was 15. And I remember the first drink that counted was in the front of 94 George Street in Sydney, Nova Scotia. Now, if you know where that is. And why would I know it's in front of 94 George Street in Sydney, Nova Scotia? And the answer is because that's the house my father lost because of his alcoholism. And we had lived there. And we had moved over to what was called the tough part of town, or the poor part of town, whatever you want to call it. A bunch of us had come back over town for a party that night. And it just happened that that's where the fellow pulled out this bottle of $9.99 wine. Yeah. Now, I don't know if you're from the States, you probably don't know $9.99 wine, but it's kind of in golden nut would be the equivalent or something like that. Porch climber, anyway. You relate to that. So a lot of you ended up on that. I started on that. And what's important about that is that I can tell you, like so many, I've heard so many alcoholics say this, I remember the taste, I remember the smell, I remember where I was standing, I remember what it felt like, I remember, there was no big deal other than just, I heard a guy describe it this way one time, so it was just like somebody came up in back of me and just tightened up all the screws. It just, everything fit together right the way it was supposed to do. And sufficient to say that over the years after that, I mean, I drank often, and I drank more often, and I took more, and I felt great, like every other alcoholic I've heard as well. When I drank, I felt good. I heard a guy yesterday talking about, you know, when we do our fourth step, we're really identifying the things that are keeping us from being the people we're supposed to be. And I thought, that's really a neat idea. I never thought of it that way. I never heard it exactly in those words, but that's a wonderful thought. But that's what alcohol did for me, too. Like, all of a sudden, when I was 15 and 16, I felt like the person I was supposed to be. You know, I played sports better. I really did. You know, we played football. I would quarterback. We'd win. We'd play baseball. I'd pitch. We'd win. And I never noticed the difference, you know, that I drank more and I drank more and I drank more. And I was one of those guys that always had to win. I always had to be in charge. I had to be in the front. Contrary to whatever should happen, you know, when I was living in the neighborhood I was living in, which again, like I said, was supposedly the tough part of town, and I didn't feel tough. I mean, I felt so out of place it wasn't even funny. I used to think that sooner or later they're going to figure this out. Guys around, all the tough guys I'm hanging around with are going to figure this out. And they're going to know that I'm not supposed to be here. And then they're going to turn on me. It never quite happened that way. And funny is bizarre the way the thing turned out. We won't get into it right now. But the bottom line is that most of the tough guys that I hung out with went to university from that neighborhood. We were kind of really, you know, a contradiction in terms. Half the guys went to jail and the other half went to university. So I went to university and I drank more and I started to get in trouble at university. And I just started to get in trouble. I got out of it, but anyway, it started to have an effect there. I got through university, and when I was in university, I got a job for the summer. It was just by accident that I got it, and with the parole service. So I was a parole officer, a student parole officer one summer, and I loved it. God, I loved the job. We had a boss that said to us, you know, your job is to supervise people and to be in contact with them and so on and so forth. And as long as you're getting the work done, I don't care what hours you work. Great. And I used to work day and night. I really did. I worked really hard. I would be up early in the morning, and I'd be out, and I'd be up, but I'd be out at late at night, too. And I would go to all the places that people wanted to go or were afraid to go to. And I thought it was just wonderful. And then I went back to university to finish up. And when I came out of university, by this time I was married, I had a baby, and I needed a job. And so I wanted to go back being a parole officer, and so I wanted to join our service. and the only job was available was in a maximum security institution in our region. I had been there one time during the summer while I was a parole officer, and I remember going in that place, and that particular institution, which we're trying to tear down right now, it's over 100 years old, and it's this old dungeon-like place, and I remember going there as a student, and I walked in, and they just slammed the door. It just clanged. And I think, oh, geez, I'm not supposed to be here, you know. And I remember visiting the place that day and driving back down the hill, and that was when I was still a student. And I remember looking back in the mirror. Somebody said yesterday, you know, happiness is someplace, they were talking about someplace, and happiness is this place in the rearview mirror, you know. And I remember seeing that place in the rearview mirror, and I'm never going back in there again, ever. When I graduated, it was the only place there was to work. And so I said, well, you know, I'll go there and I'll work there. So I went there and I went to work, and I only went there to work long enough to get in the system so I could go back to the parole service. And I ended up staying in that particular prison for 5 years. And the reason I stayed there for 5 years was I was absolutely terrified of the place. And I, you know, I'm still drinking, by the way, as this goes on. And so I did what so many of us do, you know, like I'm not supposed to be afraid of anything, and I'm not supposed to be intimidated by things and so on and so forth. And I'm afraid of this place, so therefore I will do the very things that will just tackle that fear. So I would go all the places that people wouldn't go. I would go on the ranges, and I would go in the shops, and I would go in the back alleys, and I would go here, and I would go there. Absolutely terrified all the time, but I would go there. And it was just a big lie, because there I was all the time thinking that then they're going to find out too. You know, they're asking us to, a bunch of us, to write our memories, you know, for this book they're putting together. And some of them are really funny, you know, the things you do, that the stories of things that happen because of your fear, you know. I remember one time, it was kind of like inmate field day, they call it. Every year they have this thing, and they have summer games kind of thing. And at the time, the population was divided. They could only have recreation half and half because there was so much violence going on. But this is the one day of the year everybody could be in the yard together. So there's 450, 500 inmates in the yard. Our prisons are small by U.S. standards. And I had to give the opening talk. And, you know, it was kind of like, whatever, you know, throw the first ball, you know, have a wonderful day, do whatever. And so I said, okay, I'll do that. And what I had to do, though, is I had to walk diagonally across the yard to the ball field, through the ball field, to this announcement booth, and I was just terrified. And I looked up on the building with a shotgun up there, and I looked up the building with a shotgun there, and this thought crossed my mind: they won't hurt me because it'll ruin the day. So I guess I'm okay. So I went, and as I was coming around the back of the ball field, I was about to go up the stairs, and there was a bunch of inmates sitting there, and one of them hollered, "Hey, Mike, have a good time in there." And I heard, you know, when you hear something but you don't hear it, it doesn't register. So I walked up the stairs. I went in this building. And there was two queens in there, all dressed to the nines, like they had these long nightgowns on, and they were all dressed with the lipstick and all that, and they were like, come on in. And I thought, gosh, I thought, I always knew I was going to get it in one of these places, but I didn't think it was going to be like this, you know. So it was the fastest have a good day speech you ever heard, and I was up. I come out of that place, and the guys that were sitting in the bleachers were just laughing, like they just, So anyway, so I my career kind of progressed. I started getting promoted because I would go places, and you know, that I wasn't supposed to go, or most people didn't want to go. What people didn't know is I was drinking more at home. I was drinking a lot at night. I was drinking on the weekends. I had this thing in my head at the time, you know, play, you know, work hard, play hard. You know, that's the way to do it. And after a while, though, it just got totally out of control. And I have a friend of mine who Tom also sponsored, who talks about step one. In alcoholism, we find a way of life that we really respect or we admire, we violate every principle of that way of life, and then we find a way to blame it on somebody else. You know? And that's what happened to me at that prison. I violated every principle of our service and of my job, and I would find a way to blame it on other people. And I became more erratic. I made decisions I shouldn't have made. Thank God they didn't have the repercussions they could have had. And it's not that I necessarily made bad decisions. I made decisions in a state of mind that I should not have been making decisions in, if that makes any sense to you, you know? Anyway, at some point in time, it just got to be so hectic. Like I was going to work, and then I was going home, and I would just drink, and then I would go to sleep, and I'd get up and do it again. And so I asked my boss one day, I said, look, I really think you'd be wise to move me out of here. I was like, things are not going well. And he said, yep. And, you know, I'd asked him for a lot of things over time, but that was the fastest thing I ever got, you know. And so I was out of there. And at the same time, though, he sat down and he said to me, look, he says, like, people are really worried about your drinking, you know. He said, we'll give you any job you want. And by this time, by the way, I had become a warden in that maximum security institution. He said, we'll give you any job in the service that you want if you'll stop your drinking. And I said, let me think about it. You know, I had staff members that came to me literally, physically crying, and they said, look, you're killing yourself, you know, and we don't want you to die. And you're not a bad guy, but we really want you to be around. Like, we'll do anything to help you, you know. And I said, what I do in my time is my business. You know, and that, it shames me to say that, but that was my response. Long story short, I kind of wore out my welcome, and basically I was told eventually that unless I could get it together, I was probably going to be out of a job. And that got my attention. And it is a kind of a little bit of a longer story, but I called AA, and I had been tried AA a couple of times over the years. Now, I'd gone to Alcoholics Anonymous off and on. And all I had ever heard at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not saying people didn't say something different than this, but this is what I heard. All I heard was don't drink and go to meetings and you'll be fine. That's what I heard. And my problem with that is I will drink and go to meetings no matter what, you know. And so I couldn't, I just didn't work. You know, I thought we're going to, you know, for me, Alcoholics Anonymous was going to meetings, sitting around talking about why we can't do it, you know. And I don't like not doing it. I don't like talking about it. So I'll go and do it, you know. It was just a terrible, terrible time in my life. In the meantime, my family's growing, my kids are suffering. My boy, who's 15 years old, who I loved dearly at the time, writes me a letter and says, I'm crying as I'm writing this letter. Can you imagine a 15-year-old having to write that letter? And I said, I will stop drinking for him. And I did. For a year and a half. And then they, I didn't do anything about it, so that day came when I thought I was going to go absolutely insane if I didn't drink. And so I drank. And then I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I came in contact with people who understood the program of recovery as laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they were talking steps, and they were talking sponsorship, and they were talking service, and they were talking all the things I had never heard in a couple of years before Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had met a guy, and they had made me promise to get a sponsor. And I said, fine. I asked this guy, will you be my sponsor? And he said, yes, I will. I said, good. Here's what we're going to do. And he said to me, be quiet. And I almost threw him out of the house. And he said to me this. This is really important for me. He said, you don't know anything about alcoholism, and therefore you don't know anything about recovery. And he said, because you don't know anything about recovery, you can't do anything, so you're going to die. But you don't need to die. And you don't need to know anything about the process of recovery, because I'm going to teach you what my sponsor taught me, and what my sponsor taught me is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, we're going to read the book together, and we're going to pay attention to the verbs, and where it says write, we write, and where it says pray, we pray, where it says consider, we consider, where it says do, we do. He said, and you will get better in spite of yourself. And at that instant, I felt this weight. Honestly, God, I'm not exaggerating. It was like, whoop, you know? And I thought, I can stop trying to figure it out. I didn't know I was trying to figure it out until I said that to myself. You know? So for the next year and a half or so, Bob and I, who was my sponsor at the time, worked hard and we did the steps. And I found out that I was dishonest and that I shaded everything to suit me. I was terrified. I didn't understand my alcoholism. I thought it was a mental and emotional weakness. That's what I really, I didn't know I thought that. But I did. And my family got restored, and my credibility, my job got restored, and so on and so forth. And that's really the shortcut to that story. I was 7 years sober. I'd done the steps. I'd made the amends. There's absolutely incredible things happened to me in the amends process, by the way. My boss called me in the office one day, one of my numerous bosses, and over the period of time, and I was 7 years sober, and he said to me, you know, you're doing really, really well at work. What do you want to do? He said, you can have just about any job you want. I'd really like to go back and be a warden again. That wasn't a bad job, and I'd really like to do that. And he said, it's never going to happen. And I'm sitting there, and with like the alcoholic I am, I wanted to go right over the desk after him. Now, I'd had all the miracles in our steps. I had the miracles in the amends. I mean, AA had been just wonderful to me. This guy says you're not going to be a warden anymore because you were too volatile when you were there, and nobody's going to take that chance again. You know, and just to prove him wrong, I want to go over the desk after him, right? With every bone, every fiber of my being, I wanted to hurt him. And it took every fiber of my being to say, God, let me say anything except what's about to come out of my mouth. And what came out of my mouth was this. You may be right. You may be right. But I'm 7 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and who knows how people are going to think when I'm 10 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was appointed warden of the same institution I was removed from when I was 10 years and 5 days sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. To quickly wrap up, the last 5 years I've spent at another institution, which is a release preparation institution where we get guys ready to go to the community. And we're the biggest in the federal one in the country. I've learned more about Alcoholics Anonymous and about the need for Alcoholics Anonymous, the participation of Alcoholics Anonymous in the institutions in the last 5 years than I had ever known in my life. Okay? Our place, you know, it's fun. Oh, God, I could go on forever. We have a roundup once a year at our place, and somebody had talked about helping correct the correctional system, you know. We have a roundup once a year at our place, and there's no security clearance required to come to the roundup. And see what happens. We're up on a hill. Here's my thinking, right? There's a road down there, and there's a road there. You come up the road, you go into the gymnasium, you go to the roundup, you get on the road, you go down there. What's the big deal? So anybody that's an Alcoholics Anonymous who wants to come to the roundup, come to the roundup, you know. Our inmates, we've had Alcoholics Anonymous folks come in at our institution, and I see Bruce, a friend of mine standing down there, was one of the guys working with this program. We'd have AA people coming in once a week, and they'd come into the institution, and they'd meet with the guys in their houses. Our guys would have them in for coffee. They'd sit down and have meetings, Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, in the houses. And inmates from the other houses would ask to go to the houses. So we'd jam the houses the other time. And we'd have inmates asking to go in that, to be allowed to participate in that program. The community coming in. See, our biggest problem, our inmates' biggest problem is they don't think they deserve to be citizens. They don't think they deserve to be citizens. And it's our job to convince them to have every right to be citizens. They are citizens. You know, they're good people. They're in jail because they're alcoholics. And if we can tackle their alcoholism and help them do what they need to do, they'll come out of jail and stay out of jail. Let me finish and tell you this. A friend of mine I heard one time, Alcoholics Anonymous, talked about, this is a spiritual program. I have no doubt about this. Okay, what's powerful about our program is the spirituality of the program. My sponsor, Tom, talks about, there's a synergy here. There's a synergy because there's so many of us here that want to do something in alcoholism. But there's a power way beyond that power, that makes miracles happen. Yeah. You know? And I've watched miracles happen in our institution. And I've watched spirits revived in our institution. And I'll tell you, the most spiritually uplifting thing you can do is have people come in from the community, take people who are absolutely beat to death, beat down, and help pick them up and take them back out to the community. It's the most wonderful thing you can do. Father Martin, I can just quote him, in talking about step 12 one time, talked about, and here's the step for which we were created in the first place. I think that's absolutely wonderful. I think Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely wonderful. I think our inmates are absolutely wonderful. I served, the previous speaker said he had served 32 years in the service. I'm 32 years in the service, in our service. And the plan right now is that I'll retire in September. And so I left the institution I was at, taking the summer off. And one of the highlight of my career was this, and I'll close with this. One of the inmates came up to my office a couple of weeks ago, and he's a real solid guy. He's one of the inmate leaders in the place. And he said, the guys wanted me to give you this note. So he gave me the note. And what the note said was, we didn't want you leaving here thinking that you hadn't gotten something done. You were there for us. And we're grateful for it. That was the biggest thing that could have happened to me. It was just absolutely wonderful. So I think Alcoholics Anonymous is wonderful. I think this conference is wonderful. I think our inmates are wonderful. I think you are wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike C. That was wonderful. Before I introduce the next speaker, I just wanted to give you some statistics about corrections in the United States. Unfortunately, we have over 2 million people locked up in jails and prisons in the United States. On any given day in America, 1.5 million children have one or two parents locked up in our prisons or jails. Those are terrifying statistics, but it's people like you in this room coming into our prisons and institutions that will help us overcome that. And someone asked me earlier, the problem is so huge, how can we get our arms around it? And I often say when I talk to people in public, I can't put my arms around the 165,000 offenders we have locked up in our prisons and jails, but you at the local communities can put your arms around one person at a time, one day at a time. So keep that in mind. It is really a privilege to be able to introduce the next speaker, Diane, who I met a few years ago when Roger asked me to speak at the 50th anniversary of Hospital Institution Division coming into prisons in Santa Rosa, California, because the first prison they came into was San Quentin, where I was then the warden. And that was such an uplifting experience for me, because while I always recognized the power of AA coming into San Quentin, I didn't realize the impact when people left the prison. So I spoke at that group. There was 300 or 400 people in the audience. And when I was done speaking, the line coming up to shake my hand to thank me for being there was just, it was amazing. And people would come through the line and they would say things to me. If you see Father O'Neill, please thank him for telling me to go to AA. Or if you see this teacher or that officer who told me to go to AA, please tell him I'm doing well. And it was so inspiring that I really, really made a commitment to be involved in AA. And so it's such a pleasure to be here. Diane was there that day, and she said she wanted to put my name forward to be a part of AA in some way, and I went, okay. I had no idea what it meant, and I just kept going. So here I am today, and it's a pleasure to introduce Diane. Thank you.
I'm Diane, I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everyone. God, isn't this wonderful? Fabulous. Oh, full room, Mike. You know, when Jeannie called me, what do we do before cell phones? What in the heck did we do? When Jeannie finally caught up with me yesterday afternoon on my cell phone just leaving the convention center and asked me to participate today, I was so thrilled. I had never felt more overwhelmed and more grateful for this incredible fellowship than I did in that moment. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And before I begin, I must tell you there are some very, very important things that I always pass on when I'm sharing. Number one is my sobriety date, which I am deeply grateful because I would have been dead many, many years ago had I not been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous locked up. My sobriety date is August the 30th, 1974. And I have an incredible... I have incredible sponsors. They're in this room today. One of them ran Hurt on Me for my first 15 years, and the second is running Hurt on Me for my next 15. I always believe in having rock-solid anchor right where I am. My first sponsor, Pat, moved to Grants Pass, Oregon, and I asked her sister, Peggy, to sponsor me, and both of them, when I came in, had been sober longer than dirt, and that was 1971. Pat, February the 18th, Peggy, May the 5th. I have a home group, the Cupertino Women's Group in Cupertino, California, from which I come. And I have the most amazing commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous. I've always been committed. I've always been in service because that's the kind of sponsorship I've had. And from day one, I have been led by very bright lights down the path of sobriety. But today I am so profoundly grateful for the Northern California Hospital and Institution Committee and the privileged work we get to do there. The shepherdess of our flock, our fearless leader, our chairperson, Marcelo, is here today. And so are, I don't know how many others. How many Northern California guys are here? Let's see those hands. Yeah. Hi, everybody. I must tell you, I've just finished reading the most amazing book, The Story of San Quentin by Clinton T. Duffy, the warden that recognized the need for Alcoholics Anonymous in 1942, the warden who inherited for 30 days a blackboard jungle, an unbelievable situation in which the prisoners, the inmates, were not treated well, more like animals than human. And the very first day that Clinton Duffy took over as warden, he walked the yard alone. He walked the yard without guards. And he let those guys know that he trusted them and he had faith in them. because his focus, as was Jeannie's, as is Jeannie's, was rehabilitation, not punishment. And he did so many incredible things. This book was published in 1950. It's out of print now, but we found it on Amazon.com. The stories that are told of his reaching out to inmates from the death row inmates on down are nothing less than amazing. He turned the whole prison around with a lot of love and light and compassion, understanding and kindness where there had not been any. And the prisoners were involved in things like bands and choral groups and sports events. And then there's stories, you know, he closes the book with one that I've cried so many times reading. I'm not even sure I can get through it, but he's in the visiting room and he's thinking about some of the edifices, some of the things that are still prevalent at San Quentin, but how much the inner has changed. And he's aware that there's a prisoner there, and he's looking very longingly at a beautiful young woman holding a baby. He knows the baby belongs to this prisoner and that he's never seen the child before because he's been down for 7 months and the baby's only maybe 4 months old. And, of course, he's not allowed to touch this child. And Warden Clinton T. Duffy looks at the longing in this prisoner's eyes, this inmate's eyes, and says to him, you haven't seen your little girl before, have you? And he said, no, sir. And he said, I bet you haven't held her either then, of course. And he said, no, sir. And he said, take her. Well, the guard just reacted because it was way against the rules. And Duffy said, let him have his child. And this young man took his baby, his little blonde baby, and held her in his arms and put his chin against her blonde curly hair. And the tears started streaming down his face. And Duffy said, I know he'll do his time well. He said, you know, said to the guard, I'd much rather break a rule than break a heart. So, San Quentin Prison, because Jeannie and David and Mike, I want to thank all three of you. Wow. It's a fabulous panel. It makes me even more deeply grateful, and I'm so privileged to do what I'm doing. San Quentin, you know, Jeannie has just done so much for our Alcoholics Anonymous groups and for the inmates there. And one of the things, Jeannie and I were talking one day, and I heard the word squires. And her husband actually said, Eric said something about, oh, squires are meeting today. And I said to Jeannie, what is squires? And she said, San Quentin utilization of inmates' experiences, resources, and studies. San Quentin utilization of inmates' experiences, resources, and studies. Squires. What do squires do? They don't scare straight. They communicate. That was the first thing Jeannie said to me. They don't scare straight. They communicate. At-risk kids are brought in a couple Saturdays a month. And these inmates share with them, communicate with them. So pray God these kids do not end up. Now, these are lifers, a lot of them. These squires are lifers at San Quentin. And they're counseling these kids so they do not have to end up behind the walls as they are. I shared this at a conference last week. I called Jeannie because I was in tears. One of the girls I sponsor, sitting in the audience, just listening, went, wow, she has a teenager at risk. She calls San Quentin. She gets put right through to Marie. And her boy is going to San Quentin next Saturday for his first choirs. And I have a feeling you had a hand in that, too. I'm going to come at it just a little bit differently. I want to just share some of my profound experiences working with the inmates going in behind the walls to a couple of the prisons that I am privileged to be cleared to enter. The message was brought to me almost 31 years ago, locked up. And I got to tell you, nobody had ever gotten through to me before. I'd been an island unto myself, a roaring tornado. I'd broken the hearts of my family. They had just chosen to have to let go of me. And I had done a run across the country and into Spain. And, you know, I just had burned bridges everywhere I'd gone. And trouble was my middle name. And I had been that way since I was born. But alcohol certainly exacerbated it and sent me on a run. Why Alcoholics Anonymous had never been presented to me before, I do not know. I'm only grateful that they were there somewhere in May 1974. And I'll never forget being escorted into that room and seeing these bright-eyed, bushy-tailed people all talking at the same time at each other. And, you know, I was being forced to do something I didn't want to do, and that did not work well for me. You know, I was one of these that did not ask for help, never admitted I didn't know anything, and had never been close to anyone. I'd never talked about myself, didn't want anyone to know what I'd done, what I'd thought, what I felt. Yeah, my entire life had been isolated, completely isolated. So these people, let me tell you, were lame. I could not believe that they were sharing their guts, that they were saying what they were saying. I sat there with my arms across my chest just as tight as I could hold them and literally glared, daring them to say, because the rest of the inmates in there with me were going, so-and-so alcoholic, and I was not going to say those words. After all, it was medicinal. Come on. If you were born into a world where you were totally uncomfortable with yourself, where you hated your guts and those around you, where you felt the world was a cheap, dirty, ugly place that did not treat you fairly, you drink too. It broke my care button. It took me out of reality. It helped me to escape from the world that I just did not fit in. I've reached the point, of course, where I'm covered with massive bruises. The whites of my eyes are yellow. I'm maybe 85 pounds, soaking wet. Everything dear to me in life is gone, and it should be gone. And furthermore, I know I do not deserve to have it back. And I'm sitting there still thinking that these guys are lame and that I'm not going to give them anything. And I didn't. But the magical message of Alcoholics Anonymous reached me. And after I was back out on the streets, and I was, and still drinking, and taking care of those yets that you all had talked about, that you're eligible to, I did them all. Whatever I hadn't done before, I did then. And for 3 months, I degraded myself and did my crimes, but didn't get caught. A couple of times, cops just didn't catch me. I'm pretty fleet of foot. And a few other times, they just weren't where I was doing my crime. I've often told the guys, there was one crime I did in New Jersey, that if had I been caught, I might still be there. So that was my story. And boy, do I identify with these inmates when I go behind the walls. And they have pulled out of my very being, out of my soul, many things that I had chosen to bury and bury deep. So they have helped me to get in touch with a lot more about Diane that even came forward in that first Fearless and Searching Moral Inventory and others that followed it. So I must tell you that from the very beginning, I've been involved in hospitals and institutions, but I've also had the privilege of doing other services in Alcoholics Anonymous, but always with my heart knowing where I belonged. And even my very wise sponsor said, you know, it's great the service you're doing, but, you know, it always amazes me because you're such a recovery. You're such a recovery person. And sponsoring, working with others has always been my heartbeat. But I'll tell you, the first time that I was cleared to go into Soledad State Prison, I was exhilarated. I could not believe that with my record I was actually going to be cleared to go into this prison down in Soledad, which is about 100 miles south of where I live. I will never forget my first day there. I go to the Wednesday group, and they're called Back from the Edge, and our focus is on the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, recovery through the steps. There are lifers that have been down for a while. You know, they have been, many of them have well over 20 years of sobriety and have chosen to continue because they know this is the path. They know that even though they may never, ever leave prison, learning to live right, to do the next right thing, to do esteemable acts, gives one self-esteem. And my message is always just be a godlike, whether it's Chiselli, in the mess hall, out in the yard, just be a godlike. And these guys in the past almost decade have become my second home group and have become absolutely my soulmates down there because so many of them have taught me so much. And I want to tell you about Jorge, because he's one of my miracles. My very first meeting there, Jorge was very angry. I speak Spanish, and he didn't speak much English then. And he was very unhappy because the parole board had turned him down again. And he was one of those guys that told me about his crime. You know, he said to me, I had a very good CPA business. And I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous a couple of years. And I chose to drink again. And I was at a New Year's Eve party. It was a gang thing where I did not belong. And I was drunk to a blackout. And I had a gun. And when I woke up the next morning, I was back in prison, back in jail. And I just shrugged it off. Another DUI. Another drunk driving. And his friend came to see him, and he's laughing it off. Hey, I got drunk again. And his friend said, no. No. He shot 3 people. One is dead, and 2 are fighting for their lives. And I don't ask questions, so I don't know about the other 2. But I do know that this is what... And Jorge was down 16 years when I met him. And he was very angry. Oh, gosh, you know, it was just everybody's fault. He was still absolutely unwilling to accept responsibility. And so we've had a lot of long talks since then. And we worked through the steps in this group, and I'm always encouraging Jorge to get out of himself and do the next right thing. And, you know, the crime has been done. but you can live right today, and you can grow where you're planted today. It's all at that state prison. A few months ago, they had a little banquet for us. It's the cutest thing you ever saw. They put their dimes and nickels and pennies together, and they outside sponsors go, and they bring in these little goodies, and it's quite a mishmash of food, I'll tell you. And they eat like they used to drink, because it's so much better than the prison food. And Jorge came bebopping up to me and sat down, and just eyes just this big, and he said, Diane, I just saw the parole board again yesterday. They didn't let me out, but I thanked them. I thank them for giving me their time. He said, you know, I get it today. My life is none of my business. I have turned my will and my lives over to God's care. He's in charge today. So I'm going to grow where I'm planted right here. I probably will never get out of prison. But I'm going to do the next right thing. I'm going to do the next esteemable act. I'm going to be a godlike. And I cried so hard. I've never wanted to have an inmate like I wanted. I wanted to take Jorge, and we're not allowed to do that. And just absolutely, hug him. The deal is, he's gotten it. He's gotten the message. He's going to be okay. And he comes into those meetings now bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and just ready to share. And it's my other amazing experience that I want to leave you with, when Jeannie became Director of Corrections last year, Salinas Valley State Prison. Now, Soledad are levels 2 and 3. Because they've been down for so long. They're further away from their crime and their points are fewer. Salinas Valley is so young, and they are so current. Their crime is so new, and they're level 4. And they're 5 yards. 4 are level 4, and 1 is level 1. They do the housekeeping around. They milk the cows. There's a dairy out back. At any rate, we had never gotten in there. We had called and called and called. They didn't want literature. They didn't want us. When we heard Jeannie had been chosen to be Director of Corrections in California, we decided we're going to try again, just in case. This is only like a week later, mind you. We called down, they opened their yards to us. And not only that, they're so enthusiastic, there are 2 inside sponsors per yard. It's cute. At any rate, my husband Perry and I went down the second week. This has been just a year ago now. And we heard the first week was a little tough. The AAs that had gone down that first week had just a little bit of, you know, they'd never done this before. They'd never had an AA meeting. The inside people were trying to conduct AA, but they're not alcoholics, and so they don't know. They certainly didn't have our literature. And so we'd gotten this phone call saying, oh, it was a little tough, and they'd been in Yard A, which is a special needs guys. This was the first yard to open up. Now we have all 5 open. But Yard A, the special needs, the keep-away guys, the ones that would be murdered, could be killed if they were in another yard. They do the crimes like rape, and they're God's kids. They're just every bit as precious as everybody else, I'll tell you. So we went down, and my husband did a brilliant thing. Perry's coming. He got the inside sponsor. They had elected a group chair. So we got the inside sponsor in there early, and he sat down with the inside sponsor, and showed him how to run a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Perry came just with all of the information. We had all the books, and I arranged all of the literature on 2 different tables for the Spanish and the English, because we have a mix. And I put all the chairs in a circle. I'd heard there'd been a little bit of noise the previous week, and so we had them all facing each other. And we also heard that they hadn't bonded much. They were really, you know, they're not only isolated from the world, but they are not doing each other either, these special needs guys. And then we greet them at the door with, hi, I'm Diane, I'm an alcoholic. What's your name? First name, please, because I want to give you their last name and real rough and tough. First name, please, how about alcoholic? Yeah, we're alkies here, that's where we're coming, right? And by gosh, they just followed suit like little kids. Yeah, I'm John, I'm an alcoholic, yeah, I'm... And they're not knowing quite what to do with me. They're sure I'm whacked. But anyway, they come in, and they sit in this circle, and the chairperson just does a brilliant job running their first true meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we are thrilled. We're trying to put out some information, and we get questions like, well, I'm an atheist, what are you going to do for me? And then of course, we all know how to handle that. And then, well, you guys out on the street, you bond, and you have groups, and what are we supposed to do in here? And we tell them how you do it. You just start doing it right now. And you can see them sitting around the circle, just not doing each other either, just rigid. But they are overwhelmed with the fact that we're in there, and they can't quite grasp the fact that there's all this literature that they can have, that they get to take back. In Northern California, we have these beautiful little pink cans, They're pink and white. They're mainly pink. And they pass themselves around at all of our meetings, and we put in our dimes and nickels and quarters and bills occasionally. And we are the single largest purchasers of Alcoholics Anonymous literature in the world today. Yeah. Those little pink cans probably bring in close to $500,000 a year to take to our inmates and to our jails and hospitals, people that are locked up, that are confined. And that includes our grapevine and our Lavina. So we're very grateful for those little pink cans. And let me tell you, you know how much they're appreciated when you go behind the walls. Any rate, after this meeting, they're clustered around us, talking to us, shaking our hands, and there's been a transformation. Something magical has happened. You know, there's magic in every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they're starting to talk to each other. We've encouraged that. You can go out in the yard. You can bond. You can start right here. They didn't come in talking to each other that night. They left talking to each other and starting to communicate and make little plans to, because we made the suggestions to do so. But the one that touched me, Ernie came up with a big book. And he was holding it like this. And he looked at me, and his eyes had tears in them. And he said to me, I just can't tell you, Diane. I have two life sentences. I'm never going anywhere. I can't believe that you're bringing these meetings into us, that I have these meetings to go to, and that I can take, and I really take this book back to my cell with me? He was just, and I started to cry. If I've ever been grateful for the pink cans, it was in that moment. We've watched this group grow and blossom. We're now doing a book study. They're bonding. It's almost been a year, and you would not recognize the transformation in these beautiful children of God that just are no different than any of the rest of us. They got caught. You know, halfway through my ninth step, I woke up, tells us in our big book that we get to do that. We work the steps for the purpose that they are written in sobriety one day at a time. And I woke up to the fact that we're all God's kids, each and every one of us. There are no grandchildren, no stepchildren. We're all God's kids. And each and every one of us is created out of his love for one reason and one reason only, to be about his business, to be channels through which he comes forth into his creation. I truly believe that God made us so that he could experience himself through us. So I ask all of you, what greater blessing can a human being have than to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, where we get to carry the message of hope to those who are in darkness, to help them climb their way out of the land of the living dead into the land of the living, and going beyond that to reach behind the walls of these institutions and do this fabulous correction work, to bring in love and light and hope into the inmates that are just like we are, they're God's kids, and that wouldn't get that if it weren't for us and for the blessings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for asking me to share.
Thank you to all three of our speakers. Do we have time for questions, do you think? I think we have time for a couple of questions. Yes. I don't know if that's working or not, but we'll find out.
Hello. Hi, I'm Hugh. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a couple questions, if I may, please. I'm from a Midwestern town near Green Bay, and we're getting ready to open up a brand new facility. It's a county facility, not a prison. AA has never been allowed in this, and I'm looking for some direction from these people. If someone would come forth and sort of be my jail sponsor, I'd love to have that. And also, I'd like to know if there's any particular thing that both I will be involved with the administration of the jail and also as a member of Alcoholics, if there's anything we should watch out from as an administration standpoint and also as a mistake from Alcoholics Anonymous or maybe an overzealousness of Alcoholics Anonymous to come to the facility. So if I could have a comment in that regard from anybody actually in the room, I'd be most helpful. And I'd also like to have a couple names after the meeting. Thank you.
Okay, we have a volunteer here.
I'm Julia Goodwin. I'm an alcoholic. I'm currently serving as the Northern Illinois Area Corrections Chair. We do a lot of work in the county jails and also the state prisons. You also have a very active corrections person in southeastern Wisconsin, Joe Mick. I'd be surprised. Joe Mick, are you here? Maybe not. I can put you in touch with her afterwards if you want to just meet me up here afterwards, you.
Thank you. I do want to comment from the administration side. I think it's very important that you have a really clear and good training program that you can present to prison administration so they understand how you train people that are coming in. And then it's important that you have some organization where you're meeting, hopefully on a quarterly basis, with prison administration so they know exactly what you're doing and how you're trying to grow. Communication is just very critical.
I'm Ernie Alcoholic from Washington State. Mr. Pittman, when I was on the H&I committee in Northern California, we were working on doing with the Department of Corrections on an outside campus. I believe you just opened them up in the 80s. I knew you from somewhere. But we were working that you'd house the AA members overnight and feed them. And did that ever come to fruition?
Who is that question for?
Yeah,
Mr. Fitzhand?
I believe he was.
Mr. Fitzhand?
Yeah, he was Department of Corrections chair at that time.
Do you think that? No. The answer to that is no.
Yeah. Yeah. It didn't ever. Well, thank you.
Thank you. We have time just for one more question, unfortunately.
Hi, I'm Maura. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Laura.
I'm a teacher at a California State Correctional Facility in Paso Robles. It's a California Youth Authority. I've been there 12 years. I've been advocating for 12 years to get programs into our institution. They've been approved by Sacramento, by all the big wigs, and then they come back. We have a group ready to come into the institution, and security closes the door on them. And so I'm a classroom teacher, and I'm wondering now that the corrections has now merged Youth Authority with the California, the prison system, I hope that we can get, Gene, maybe you know, can we now provide 12-step programs to our youth that are incarcerated, that are looking at prison when they turn 18, I hope.
Well, effective July 1st, the new name of the California Department of Corrections is the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And a new part of the organization is a part called Community Outreach, and the whole goal of that part of the organization is to bring in outside volunteers and groups like AA to adult offenders and juvenile offenders. So in the next few months, you will absolutely see that.
I hope so, because my son is getting out of prison in 2 weeks, who's been incarcerated for 2 years and has yet to hear anything about 12-step.
And it's our goal that never happen again. So over the next few months, I think you'll see dramatic improvement.
Well, I hope
so. So if you would join me in closing with the Serenity Prayer, please. Thank you so much.